Okay, and I guess I'll just go ahead and get started then. Thank you all for being here with us tonight. My name's Kathy Morrison, and this is the third of a four-part series on bias and prejudice for moms who parent children of color. I think you can all hear me now, but can you all confirm whether you can see my slideshow? Last week, I thought I was sharing my slideshow because Zoom told me I was, but I wasn't, apparently. Oh, good. You can see my slideshow? Yay. Okay. So we're in good shape right now. That's good. All right. Let's go ahead and get started then. I think for a lot of us, it's been a rough several days, including today. After Ruth Bader Ginsburg died on Friday, I was thinking about my workshop for tonight. And I thought, you know, I bet I can find a piece of wisdom from her that would be relevant for us as we continue our anti-bias work. And of course, it was easy to find a quote that applied because A, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was very wise, and B, she fully believed in justice and equality. And then the news came down this afternoon from Louisville that after months of waiting for an indictment on the Breonna Taylor case, the only charges that were brought were three counts of wanton endangerment against one of the officers involved in killing her. So I just want to say that I recognize that this is a really painful day for a lot of people, particularly Black Americans. And I recognize that discussing our topic tonight doesn't feel big enough to answer to the violent way that Breonna and so many others have died. But I do hope that in educating ourselves about the roots of bias and racism, and by doing the difficult work of discussing these topics, that we are at least chipping away at the base of that pyramid of hate that we looked at last week. Okay, I see your note that you're going to be all in caps, Vern. So thank you. That'll help me a lot. So before I forget, let me go ahead and read the quote that I chose from Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She said, "I'm a very strong believer in listening and learning from others." So if you've been participating in this anti-bias series for the past couple of weeks, or if you've watched the replays, you know that we've been doing a lot of learning from each other here. And I really appreciate that. Just to give you a little background on me, in case you haven't been here, I am a tribe member myself, and I live in Dallas with my husband and two kids. My daughter is 13, and my son is 9. I have a long background in education, including teaching middle school and high school, and I currently am an educational consultant, and I specialize in anti-bias training for adults and anti-bullying workshops for kids. Also, I'm a mother who's parenting transracially. That is to say, my husband and I are white, and our kids are Latinx, so they're adopted. My daughter's from Guatemala, and my son's birth parents are Mexican. So he was born right down the road in Fort Worth. And actually, today we're celebrating his adoption day. So 9 years ago today, we are at the courthouse making everything official forever. So it's a happy day. September 23rd is a happy day in our family. So this webinar series was designed for anyone parenting children of color, whether you're white like me or whether you're a woman of color yourself. That said, all are welcome to participate in our conversation, whether you're a parent or not. I think we're facing some Obviously, facing some traumatic and stressful times in our society right now. So, all voices and experiences are welcome here. So, we're just trying to understand what's happening in our society, and we're trying to work together to come up with some ideas to make things better. So, just like in previous weeks, feel free to shoot me questions in the chat as we go. In fact, I'm going to be asking you to participate in some discussions and activities using the chat. I like to channel everyone's brain power and experiences in these kind of sessions. Vern has already reminded you that when you use the chat, if you can go ahead to the drop-down box in your chat box and choose all panelists and all attendees, that way everybody will be able to see your comment, not just me. Sometimes what happens is the comments go by so fast in the chat. If I'm involved in something else or just so absorbed in what I'm saying, I might miss it. So Vern's going to keep an eye on the chat to make sure that nothing major goes by while I'm talking, but she won't be able to see it unless you put all attendees. Okay. Speaking of the chat, I'm so grateful for the incredible participation that we've had in these sessions so far. You have all been so respectful and patient with each other and with me, and that is just what we need as we navigate these topics, which can be so awkward, but also even traumatic. So here we go. As I said, today is the third in a series of anti-bias sessions that Corinne asked me to put together. As you can see on the slide, today's session is about our children's identity and the problematic concept of colorblindness. Next week, we'll finish the series talking about how racism and white privilege are two sides of the same coin. And here is a lightning quick review of last week when we talked about microaggressions. So to refresh your memory or to fill you in quickly if you weren't here, microaggressions are subtle, often unintentional forms of prejudice. They often take the form of inadvertently painful jokes, offhand comments, or pointed insults. Some examples we saw last week included crossing the street when you see someone of another race coming toward you, expressing pleasant surprise when a person of color speaks English well, expecting a person of color to represent their entire race, or giving so-called compliments, like, you're so pretty for an Asian girl. Last week, we also learned that microaggressions cause psychological damage, and the result is often described as death by a thousand tiny cuts, because each little incident, it seems pretty small, but when you're hearing things like that day after day, there is a cumulative effect that is really damaging to the psyche. So they have physical consequences as well. Even premature aging at the cellular level due to that stress response of the body of having to just to hear and respond to microaggressions. We also talked about the societal effect that seemingly small acts of bias can have if left unchecked. If we blow them off or ignore them, they can escalate into more severe and even life-threatening manifestations of hate. So I'm just curious, I suggested, I don't know if you remember or not, but I suggested that if you were interested to do a little homework assignment to ask your kids if they had experienced any microaggressions. Did anyone find out that they had, or did anyone have that conversation with your kids after our session last week? Okay, I'm not seeing any so far, but I will keep my eye on the chat. So I know sometimes there's a delay if you're typing and, you know. Oh, yes. And Vern says, remember, we're in a safe space to share. Thanks, Vern. That's true. As we mentioned last week, microaggressive statements can be particularly painful when they call into question a person's identity. So, for example, when someone says, you don't seem that black to me, or if they ask a biracial or brown person, what are you? It can really sting. So I mentioned last week that one of the microaggressions that my daughter has gotten a couple of times is her friends have said to her, you just don't seem very Guatemalan to me. And it hurts her because being from Guatemala and being Latina are essential parts of how she defines herself. Let's see. So Donna says, my children are often told by their white dad, who is very racist, that they're half Mexican. The dad always says, well, you are not like them. That is really hurtful because I'm sure being Mexican is part of their identity. So And she says, of course, I'm divorced. So yeah, and that is really hurtful. I'm sorry that they've heard that. I'm sure you've helped them process that as well. Okay, so thanks for sharing that, Donna. That's a very good example of a microaggression and a very good example of how a little seemingly small statement can actually just really cut somebody to the core. So, okay, here's our agenda for today. We're gonna switch to the color of color blindness. We're gonna talk about what the colorblind ideology is, and we're gonna talk about why it's flawed. We'll talk about the negative effects of colorblindness, and then we will wrap up by talking about how we can positively reinforce our children's racial and ethnic identity. So let me know in the chat with just a simple yes or no, if at some point in your life you were instructed to just not see color, like it was just better not to see color. Has anyone ever heard that before? It's just better not to see color. Have you heard that? Oh, Marilyn hasn't heard that. Stephanie has heard that. Anybody else? Do you remember being taught that? Okay, so Donna says the church teaches this. Susan said she hasn't heard it. So I remember learning that lesson. I don't really remember exactly where. I just feel like it was coming from lots of different places. Color blindness is basically the belief that we shouldn't see color or race because as people, we're all the same. So this ideology was actually part of the civil rights movement in the 60s. Its intent was to eliminate the blatant racism of whites against Black people in America. So by explicitly recognizing that race does not and should not matter, the intent of color blindness was to treat all races as identical so that race could no longer be used as a basis to discriminate. Now, to be clear, not all civil rights activists endorsed this approach. This was more of an assimilationist approach in the vein of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But people like Malcolm X and others who were part of the Black Power movement did not endorse this ideology in any way. So I won't go too far into those details, but I'm going to hold up a book. And this is on my reference sheet that's in the bonus course section of the PNP website. So you don't have to write this down right now if you don't want to, but if you want to know more of those details about the civil rights movement and who the players were and the history and all that, I highly recommend this book. It is called Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You. It's by Jason Reynolds and Ibram X. Kendi. It's a very quick and easy read. And it helped me clarify not only the history of racism, which goes back as far as like the 1400s, but who all the different players were in the civil rights movement. I mean, because I recognized all the names, but didn't know exactly what each of those people did. So it's a really quick read. It's written for a young adult audience. So it really goes really fast and gives a really concise history. So just a suggestion. Anyway, back to the colorblind ideology. I think that we have all heard Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. And you probably recall, with my screen's going crazy here. You probably recall the famous line when he says that people should be judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. And while what he said was true, white people in particular ran with that idea, and it morphed into a philosophy that race is something that should just be ignored. So to this day, there are a lot of people who still hold on to that idea. So what I want to ask you as a discussion question for the chat is, why do you think this colorblind approach would be attractive to people? Why do you think that colorblind approach is an attractive approach to race for some people? Oh, and I noticed that Fern just put my my reference sheet in the chat too, so you can find that reference to that stamped book in there. Stephanie says this is a convenient ideology for people because you don't have to acknowledge the differences in the way people who aren't white have been treated. Agree. Joanne says it feels more comfortable because you're looking at similarities instead of differences. Yes. Marilyn says it would make them feel that they're the same. Mm-hmm. Donna, it's an excuse to treat people poorly. They don't have to face their racism. Okay. Yes. So let's be honest. Being colorblind does seem like an easy solution to the extraordinarily complex problem of racism. So if I don't see color, I don't have to deal with it. So I don't have to figure out how to think or feel about people who are different from me. And also nobody can accuse me of being a racist if I say I don't even see color, right? But there's one basic problem with that. So here you see two pictures of extremely talented and gorgeous women, Taraji P. Henson and Uma Thurman. Both are award-winning actresses. They've both appeared in several hit films. They're the same age, so they both turned 50 this year, like me. And they both even have their hair styled and gorgeous little loose curls here. But you do notice a difference when you look at them, right? Because yes, newsflash, Taraji is Black and Uma is white. So of course we notice that because guess what? Everyone sees color. So to be colorblind is fundamentally, literally impossible. And what's more, the ideology of colorblindness negates the beauty of diversity. So why would we ever want Uma and Taraji to be exactly alike? It also perpetuates racism by denying the existence of implicit bias in the current reality of systemic racism. The truth is, as humans, we do see color, and our brains, whether we want them to or not, react to what we see. So our habit brains don't care if we suddenly declare ourselves to be colorblind. When we see color, which we will, our brains are probably going to feed us some implicitly biased thoughts, which we're going to have to deal with. So similarly, there's no such thing as a post-racial society. Remember when Barack Obama got elected and everyone was throwing the term post-racial around? It was like, yay, we don't have to worry about racism anymore. Well, just because we've had a Black president doesn't mean that society's institutions have stopped perpetuating systemic racism. So just because Kamala Harris is on the ticket with Joe Biden doesn't mean that highly qualified Black applicants will get the home loans they're asking for, or that hiring managers are suddenly going to start calling in people of color for interviews as often as they do white people. So it's a much more complicated issue than just saying, oh yes, it's over. We're done. We're done with racism. So how does it feel for a person of color when somebody proudly declares themselves to be colorblind? This is what Laura Cathcart Robbins says, and she's Black, by the way. She says, when a white person tells me things like, I don't even think of you as Black, or I really don't see color, there is always a nefarious undercurrent that makes my skin crawl. The subtext feels like, I'd rather not have to think of you as Black, or it's easier for me to like you if I don't see your color. Kathy Nguyen, who is Vietnamese American, says, by saying you don't see color, you're washing away centuries of oppression and discrimination against people of color. With me, you wash away my history and my culture. You destroy a huge part of me. You destroy my identity. You destroy a huge part of my reality. You destroy the beauty of me. So Stephanie just pointed out in the chat, unless you're blind, it's a lie that you don't see color. It's very true. And Marilyn says, by saying you don't see color, it means I'm invisible. So Marilyn is black. So she's felt this invisibility when people have said that. Okay. So let's discuss some things together in the chat. And I hope you don't mind typing in some answers to these. What do you think about this first one? Who benefits most from the ideology of colorblindness? Who do you think benefits most? So Jay says racists benefit. Okay. It is considered to be a racist ideology. It's very, very cleverly disguised because it sounds like, I love everyone. I don't see color, but really it's more like avoiding seeing color. So Joanne says white people with power. White people, Jamie says. Stephanie says people who are racist or want to not acknowledge racism in our society. Donna, white people who want to whitewash their power. Yes. Okay. How about this next question? Let's see. Has the history of being colorblind? So I'm talking about the history you learned in school, but maybe even history, you know, as you were growing up that you absorbed through watching the news and other media sources. Has that history been colorblind? And Donna says, of course it has. Stephanie says, yes, I learned more about the truth in history from Prince than in school. Yeah, no, I think you can learn a lot from those Prince lyrics. And what a shame that the schools have let us down in such a way. Okay, so here's another one. I hope I'm not cutting off anybody. Do the communities and institutions in your life seem to operate in a colorblind way? So Marilyn, are you answering I'm guessing y'all are answering number three. So do the communities and institutions in your life seem to operate in a colorblind way? I'm seeing Marilyn and Joanne are saying no. So when you say that they don't operate in a colorblind way, is that because they celebrate diversity, or what do you mean? Donna says it depends. This format of like the webinar and the chat box is a little difficult sometimes to have a, you know, quick back and forth discussion, but hopefully y'all took typing in high school. I did not. I'm the worst typist. And then I'm the worst texter too. I never catch up with my friends in our text groups. But so the institutions sometimes seem to be colorblind or operating in a colorblind way. So Joanne and Marilyn, are you saying that they don't operate that way because they're trying to celebrate diversity? Joanne says, mostly I see racism happening overtly nowadays. Oh, I see. So kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. So going so far the other way that there's a negative perspective on race and difference. Okay. Let's go on to the next one. So is there a difference, do you think, between the colorblindness ideology and blatant prejudice? So Marilyn's clarifying, I'm saying that communities and institutions don't operate in a colorblind way. So you're saying that there, are you saying, Marilyn, that there's discrimination in communities and institutions? Yes. Okay. Thanks for clarifying that. So do y'all think there's a difference between colorblindness ideology and blatant prejudice? Vern says yes. What do you think the difference is, Vern? Okay, so the intent. So you think there's more intent with the blatant prejudice? So Stephanie says, people who are blatantly prejudiced, oh, my chat kind of went off the side of the screen. Let's see. People who are blatantly prejudiced don't try to hide it. That's true. I do think there are a couple things going on here. And Joanne says subtle undertone. Right. Colorblindness is more of a subtle undertone. I think there might be a couple of things going on. I think there are people who really are convinced that that they're doing the right thing by trying to be colorblind. For as dismissive as it is with regard to the beauty of diversity, I think there is a certain sector of people who think that they're doing the right thing. I mean, granted, it's the easy way out. But on the other hand, I think in some cases it could be like a sugarcoating on the prejudice, right? Like a mask almost. Okay. And Joanne says, yes, she says there's a difference between colorblindness ideology and blatant prejudice. Jamie says colorblindness is dismissive. Yes, it definitely is. I mean, I have actually walked in, it doesn't happen that often, but at least two or three times I've walked in to facilitate a workshop on bias. And somebody will just announce to me like, that they basically don't need it because they're colorblind, so it's all okay. You know, so yeah, there's definitely a dismissive kind of like, I don't have anything to learn because like there's nothing to learn. That's part of it for sure. And Donna says, or they have black friends. So yes, I've heard this before. I have black friends, so duh, I must not have any racism going on. So Marilyn says, with colorblindness, I'm ignored. With prejudice, I'm seen for my blackness. Yeah, I think that makes a really good distinction. So thank you for your perspective, Marilyn. I can totally see what you mean there. Okay, let's see. What's next? What happens when we recognize that our society is multiracial and multi-ethnic? So what happens when we recognize that our society is multiracial and multi-ethnic? Joanne says awareness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, for sure. Vern says we are more open and honest. Agree. Mm-hmm. I think it forces us to kind of have a reckoning with reality and you know, how our society treats different groups of people according to color. Marilyn says, I can recognize a multiracial and multi-ethnic society all day, but if others don't recognize it, what difference does it make? Excellent point. Super excellent point. Okay, and I have one more question. And this is a question, to our mothers, but like I know we have had some teachers in here too. So feel free to answer this according to any young people you have in your life. But what can we or our children say to somebody who professes to be colorblind. So is there a good answer? You know, if somebody, like, what should I say when I'm doing my workshop and somebody says, oh, I'm just going to be reading over here in the corner because, you know, I'm colorblind. So, you know, don't take offense, but I don't really need this anti-bias education. What can we say? Are you Stevie Wonder? Okay, so like, don't believe it, Marilyn says. Yeah. It's good advice you give your nephews. Like, you really can't believe a lot, right? Oh, that's funny because I see your red shirt. Yes. Good job, Vern. That's a good one. Okay, I love this. Adia says, then you don't see the beauty of me. That's a great response. And then Jamie says, I'd say they're missing so much beauty. And that's true. I totally agree with that. If you're a person of color, you can say, if you don't see race, you're not seeing me. Or if you don't see race, you're not acknowledging that people are actually oppressed for having my skin color. And that would be a really brave thing to say in the moment, but it's true. Also, you can't fight racism without seeing color. And it's kind of hard nowadays to kind of believe that racism doesn't exist. We all know it does. So, okay, let's go on. This is Melody Hobson. So she is a prominent businesswoman, and she has been president and CEO of several big companies, including DreamWorks for a while. She did a TED Talk called Colorblind or Color Brave. And in it, she makes the case that diversity in hiring is the key to creating successful businesses. So while I don't really know much about creating, I believe her, truly, I don't know much about creating successful businesses, so we won't go down that road, but I just love this saying that she has coined, which is color brave. And I'm going to go backtrack just a little bit because Jamie wrote something on the last slide. She said, I'd say they're missing so much beauty. My daughter would probably tell them they can't hear them and walk away, or she can't hear them and walk away. So, okay. Yes, I can understand that response. I do have a question for y'all about this idea of being color brave. So, I mean, there's color blind, which we've already decided is not only not very useful or realistic, but it's actually hurtful and harmful. What does making the transition to color brave mean to you? Like, when you hear color brave, what does that mean to you? Oh, thanks, Vern. Vern's reminding y'all, if you want everybody to be able to see your answers, you've got to check all panelists and all attendees in your little drop-down box. Otherwise, it's just me who can see, and your response, sometimes when we get going, the responses scroll up really fast and I can't see everything. So, but what does being color brave resonate with you? Do you like that expression? So Marilyn says, no, nothing. I always see color. Okay. I think we all always see color, you know. I think we've been talking about how some people are kind of trying not to, but yeah, I think it's realistic to say we all always see color. Vern says brave invites in rather than not seeing. So yes, I agree. If you're color brave, you're inviting in a new perspective, right? Instead of just essentially rendering somebody invisible. Or rendering whatever experiences that come with their skin color as invisible. Joanne says, my gut reaction is how much braver my children were to stand up for themselves than I ever was as a white child. Well, that's great. That's a testament to the confidence that you raised them with, Joanne. Yeah, my daughter is always, she was kind of born really confident. She was one of these kids who was like born like 35 years old, you know? She's always had this, we've always tried to help instill confidence in her, but she's always had this natural confidence that I admire and that I too did not have as a kid. So what's brave about recognizing that diversity exists? Does it take courage to recognize that diversity is a thing? Y'all think that is it brave to see color? Is it brave to recognize difference? I definitely think it's a little more difficult, right? Because you do have to address any implicitly biased thoughts that pop into your head. I mean, if I just go around pretending everyone has the same experience and the same skin color, it's a little easier because I'm in my own little bubble. So Marilyn says, not when you address color all day. So this is just something you do like on the regular, Marilyn. So that's what I'm hearing you say, right? So it's a way of life. Yes, I can see that. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so we're going to pivot toward, okay, so Donna says, it gets to the point where you are just tired. So you're tired of, can you explain what you're, so you're tired of explaining who you are, or can you explain what you mean a little bit, Donna? Yes, Keisha says, I think Marilyn is speaking as a person of color. It just gets old. So Keisha, what I'm hearing you say is that maybe it gets old just to even have to think about it constantly and have things pointed out constantly. Okay, so addressing color. Okay, I think I hear what you're saying. So trying to explain who I am, where you came from, et cetera, to put that on our kids is a lot. Yes, I think that's true. And I think that's part of what we talked about with the microaggressions last week, like why it wears you down so much is when people are constantly asking, like, what are you? Where are you from? How is your English so good? Like that, it's a beat down day after day. Okay, so Joanne says yes. Okay. All right, so we've recognized that that colorblind ideology is a problem. So as we have done every week, we're going to pivot now towards solutions. So we know that this colorblind philosophy can be hurtful and harmful to people of color because it negates the reality of the race-based prejudice and discrimination and even violence that people of color face. And it can just make you feel unseen and or irrelevant. So let's start talking about identity and how we can nurture it and celebrate it in ourselves and with our kids. So I decided to get really kind of fun and techie, and I'm going out on a limb with this one, but I decided it would be fun for us to try to make a group live word cloud. So don't anybody log off our call. Okay. So don't try to do this in the window that you're currently watching this call, but I'm going to have us build a community word cloud. So if you can, the first thing I want you to do is think of two or three aspects of your own identity that are most important to you. So take a moment and set those in your mind or jot them down on a piece of paper. Like, what aspects of your identity are the most important to you? Just thinking about ourselves now, not our kids yet, okay? And then what I would like you to do is to enter 2 to 3 words describing yourself into our cloud by going to my survey on menti.com. So it's really easy to get to it if you have your phone with you. You can just use this QR code and it'll take you right there. If you don't have your phone handy or your phone can't do QR codes, you could pull up a new window on your browser and go to menti.com and then enter this little code here. It's 5638441. So if you could go ahead and do that, I'm just doing it to kind of see, like, we can all collaborate together and kind of see a visual of what aspects of our identities are most important to us. And you know what I'm going to do? Because I'm going to have to advance my screen eventually. So I'm going to write the website in the chat, menti.com, and the passcode, which is 5638441. So that way you can still find it if I move on to the next screen. And I hope we don't lose anybody from the webinar because you're trying to do this, but try to open, if you're going to do this on your computer that you're watching on, try to open a new window. So if you're confused or you can't do it, don't worry about it. Just sit back and relax. And I think you'll still get something out of it. I just don't want anyone to accidentally close out. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and advance to the next slide because I think we should be able to start seeing our word cloud in real time. Ooh, I'm seeing it. It's working. Can you all see it? See if I can make it bigger. I don't know if I can do full screen, but I think we can see it. Can you all see the word cloud? So the words that are bigger are ones that people have typed in more than once. So Christian and kind must have come up more than once. Caring, food, faithful, teacher, spirit, trustworthy, Alaskan, mother, accepting. Great. I don't want to navigate away from it quite yet. I'm afraid that I don't want to leave anyone out, but we can go back to it in a couple of minutes and see if there's any more. But thank you for doing that. Thank you for humoring me. Okay. So the reason why I had y'all do that is just that it's important as parents for us to think about our own identity and to be conscious of and intentional about what we want to pass down to our kids. And every time I need to pull my chat up again. Every time I leave my presentation, the chat goes away. So I just pulled it back up again so I can see it again. Okay, so if we think about our own identity and what we want to pass down to our kids, that's a good exercise to do as parents. It might be something we've been doing all along without really thinking about it, at least in my case. I just kind of go about, you know, doing our things, our traditions and things like that without, you know, being super intentional about it, but it does happen. I think this is an interesting exercise to do with our kids too. I mean, not necessarily having them go to the trouble of making a word cloud, but asking our kids to list what parts of their identity are most important to them. So I did this with my daughter the other day and she said, she's 13. She said, athlete, artist, sister, Christian. So it was really interesting to see, you know, how she sees herself and what her identity is. Latina, she did say that as well. I mean, we don't want to box our kids in by any means since identity can be an evolving thing. But having a strong sense of who you are and celebrating who you are is beneficial in so many ways. So I would say, if you're up for it, as a little homework assignment, maybe ask your kids to list like 3 to 5 aspects of their identity and see what conversation comes out of it. So there are so many advantages to having a sense of identity and celebrating it, especially when it comes to racial and ethnic identity. So kids who have a strong sense of identity are going to be coming from a place of real confidence. And that has been shown to help school performance, mental and physical well-being, and they're having positive connotations of race. So that confidence and sense of self also puts them in a better position to face discrimination and to interact with other racial and ethnic groups. I'm just going to add a little side note here, because I think it's important. At a certain point, usually around middle school, you see kids starting to self-segregate sometimes, like in the cafeteria or other social contexts. And you see this not just with kids of color, but with other marginalized groups like LGBTQ kids. And while it might be tempting to see this homogeneous grouping together as a negative thing, it can actually be a welcoming space where kids can relax and recharge and be themselves and talk to other kids who share their experiences. So then when the bell rings and they go their separate ways to confront whatever challenges the rest of the day holds, they're coming from a place of acceptance, self-love, and confidence. So it is a developmentally normal thing for kids to group themselves like that. Unfortunately, their doing so can sometimes be misinterpreted and can sometimes make school employees and administrators and teachers, for example, uneasy if they don't understand what's behind it. So Donna says, in jail/prison. Okay, so anyway, so like, for example, if you're a school administrator, like let's say you're a school principal and you've grown up with all this media and this and these outside influences telling you that Black men are violent and scary. Like, remember the first week we talked about implicit bias and that association that the media often makes between, you know, Black men and violence. If you've got that kind of in your subconscious and you see a bunch of Black teenage boys sitting together in the cafeteria, and they're, you know, just getting goofy and rowdy like any other group of teenage boys would do, like any other silly group of teenage boys would do, it might lead to, like, I don't know, like a feeling of panic or like, what's going on here? So, I mean, that's why anti-bias education is really important for educators. So that need for a safe place, it doesn't suddenly end with high school. I don't know if y'all have read Michelle Obama's autobiography, Becoming. But if so, you might recall her description of what it was like to go to college at Princeton, which was mostly white and heavily male-dominated at the time. And she talks about a student center where she spent most of her free time called the Third World Center, which was created to support students of color. So she said it was a haven for Black, Latinx, and international students, and it was just kind of a place to hang out and eat meals together and just kind of let their hair down in between classes. So with the affirmation of her peers and the confidence that came from that, she could face the larger white-dominated university community day after day. And obviously, if you know her story, you know that she did more than just survive. She flat out excelled and wound up going to Harvard after college for law school, and then, you know, the rest is history, right? First Lady of the United States, excellent job in that role. So anyway, let's come up with some ideas for helping our kids to explore, develop, and celebrate their identity. So I'll start and put up one example. I want to hear what you already do or what you're thinking about doing too. So the first example, I stole the easy one from y'all. It's read books together. So when all of us were growing up, it was really, really hard to find characters in children's books that were not white. So you're more likely to find animals as characters than you were to see Black, Latinx, Asian, or Indigenous characters. So fortunately nowadays, I'm not saying it's the majority of books, but there are plenty of books available with diverse characters for toddlers on up to young adults. So there are lots of curated lists that you can find online. But on my resource page that Vern put in the chat earlier, I linked a couple of articles that are really recent with good lists for kids of all ages. Oh, there it is again. Thank you, Vern. So what other ideas do you have besides reading books to embrace your family members' identities? What do you already do, or have you been thinking about doing something? Oh, make ethnic meals. That's good, Joanne. You stole one of mine that's coming up. So, yes, for sure. Jay says, my daughter's senior picks, I made sure to include the Puerto Rican flag. Awesome. Yeah, my daughter's 13. She already says she wants a tattoo of a quetzal, which is the national bird of Guatemala. So kind of excited about that. But I'm like, you know, I'm like, okay, you need to wait until you're like 18 or so to get your tattoo. But I think it's cool. Donna says celebrate the holidays for sure. Stacy says visit a museum. You can do this online with the Smithsonian. Yeah, that's a good suggestion, actually. Oh, one of my big regrets about COVID is that we were about to take our kids to DC, and I was looking forward to going to all those Smithsonian museums. And now you've like reminded me, we could probably do a lot of that online. Thank you. Yeah, we took my daughter. So there's, there's a ton of art museums in Fort Worth. I'm trying to remember which one. Last year had, so my daughter is in an art magnet. So she's an artist herself, visual artist. And there was a Guatemalan artist who they featured in one of the little museums in Fort Worth who made this like a mural tunnel out of pieces of paper the size of Post-it notes. It was like made out of like just thousands upon thousands of tiny little square pieces of paper. So we took her over there to see his, and he had some other things on display too, but we try to do that, especially when we can tie in her nationality with her, or I should say her, you know, country of origin with her interest in art. That's always good. So Stacy says Native American Museum, African American Museum. Oh yeah, I'm getting on after this and looking at those Smithsonian museums. So yeah, oh Adrian, the Kimball Museum has a great indigenous collection. That's true. And I believe, Adrian, since you are evidently in my area, I think the art museum at SMU, the Meadows, has the a lot of Spanish and Latin American art too. Siobhan, so I encourage them to wear their coily hair and locks if they want to do so, and point out people who are beautiful, who are Black like them. Great idea. That's awesome. And Jay, I go to cultural festivals together. Yes. Another bummer about COVID. We will get through this though, right? There will be a day, hopefully soon, we can do the parades and the festivals again. So Adrian says the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis is profound. Okay, that's good to know. My husband and I are from Cincinnati, so oftentimes driving home for the holidays, Memphis is our place where we stop and spend the night. So that sounds like a good side trip for us to make on the way home. Great, thank you. Okay, so let's see. I confess that these ideas I'm putting up on the screen were not original. So I got them from the two articles that you see me reference on the slide here. And I referenced these articles also in my reference page. But another idea that I pulled from these articles is to use routines and rituals. And you all alluded to this already. But routines would be things like going to your weekly worship service, whatever that might be. Or nowadays, I guess it's possibly watching it streaming from the couch, right? Rituals would be things like, you know, what do you do to celebrate at the holidays or for birthdays? And of course, in some cultures, certain birthdays might be imbued with special rituals like a bar mitzvah or a quinceañera. We already mentioned this one, cook traditional meals or visit traditional restaurants. So there's a little Guatemalan bakery down the street from us that we like to go frequent with my daughter. Speak your native language at home and share stories of how you have overcome adversity. So let your kids learn from your own experience. And then honor everyone's diversity. So avoid placing one group above another. So before we wrap up, are there any questions or comments anyone would like to make about the colorblind ideology or developing a strong sense of identity in our kids? Yes. And Vern's asking if you wouldn't mind putting the ask hashtag before questions. That way we'll be able to see it better. Thank you, Vern. Okay, well, it has been another wonderful session, and I really appreciate how you've all participated in, Adrian says, ask elders to tell their stories. That's an excellent idea. I love that. I just want to say thank you for being here and participating. You know, like when, during this time of like high stress in our country, when it seems like there's so much division, like for me personally to come to a group like this and know that there's so many of us kind of working towards common goals, it gives me some peace. So I just want to say thank you for being here and for helping me through this time in our society. So all we can do is, like I said, try to chip away at the base of that pyramid of hate that we talked about last week. So I hope I see you next week for our third and final session. And it's a bit of a doozy, but I know we can handle it because we're no BS women and we can handle anything. But we're going to talk about white privilege and racism and how they are two sides of the same coin. And thank you all for being here. And Vern has just posted a link to my PowerPoint. And actually, I'm going to send along a recording of our session tonight to Kathy Hartman, and she's going to put this online within the next 24 hours. So you can come back and revisit the actual presentation if you want to. So have a great night and have a great weekend. And thank you. And thank you, Vern, for your help. It is invaluable.